I'm originally a South of the River girl, so I'm returning to my roots. Although you don't meet at St. Jerome's anymore, that was my primary school, so that was really returning to my roots when I went there. It's lovely to be here with you and to share with you this afternoon. And my talk today, I'm talking about trust. I'm sort of assuming Matt got a heads up about the theme of my talk. But if not, he was very in tune because I lost count of how many times he said trust in the first half. So you're well prepped for the theme of today. And really this talk came out of, I was having a conversation with a few people this year, and people kept mentioning that trust is a common theme in our prophetic word, and you know, we're all talk a lot about trusting God. And I start to really ponder, what do we really mean when we say we trust God? Like, what does that actually look like? And what does it look like when we're not trusting God? And sort of, sometimes I feel like these phrases we use all the time, for me, I sometimes feel like they lose meaning. And I'm like, I don't really understand what that really means. And so I really want to start by exploring this idea of trust. So I'd like you to find someone near you and talk to them about, what do you think we mean when we say we trust someone? Now, I'm not talking about God here, I'm talking about people. What do we mean when we say we trust other people? So just discuss that for a minute or two. Okay, and then a second question, very closely related to the first one. How do you know if you can trust someone? Okay, so how do you know if you can trust someone? Okay, so out of that, what I'm hoping is that we can sort of come up with a definition for trust, okay? So how would we define trust? Trust is what? I'm just going to jump around the different groups here. So we've got a group at the front here. So how do you guys, how would you define trust? Trust is what? So a couple of things there. So confidence that if someone says they'll do something, they'll do it. So they're reliable. And that if you share with them, they'll keep that confidence. So they're not going to go and blab around to everyone what you share with them. Okay, great. Up the back there, what would you guys say trust is?
Similar.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so similar things. So trust that something in the future will happen, trust in support from someone. Is that similar to what this side of the room came up with? Anything different to throw in? Yeah. Yeah, so that's great. So someone who has your best interest at heart. And I sort of broke it down into two separate categories, and I think this is really what you've covered. Did you have something to add? You look sad. No? Okay. So really those two things. A belief that someone is dependable. You can rely on them acting in a certain way. You sort of can, and that's what Matt was really talking about, and Sunith as well, that you can sort of predict what they're going to do. If they say they're going to do something, you know they're going to do it. And then the other part of it is it's really a belief that someone cares about you and isn't going to harm you. And so that's sort of that idea of that confidence, that if you trust someone, you know, you can share with them and you know they're going to keep that in confidence, because it would cause harm to you to go around and sort of share your secrets to the world. So those two aspects. So very much related, but how do we know we can trust someone then? If that's what trust is, how do we know we can trust someone? I'm going to start this way and move my hand around. So, from their credibility, yep. Anything else? Yep. So the witness of their past behaviour, yep. So they've shown themselves to be trustworthy in the past, so you know you can trust them in the future. Anything else? Yep. Yep, so that's probably similar about what you've seen happen in the past. I think also sometimes we know we can trust someone because of the relationship we have with them. And if we're in relationship and we know that, you know, if I know someone loves me and wants the best for me, then I can trust that they're going to care for me and, you know, be reliable and not want to harm me. Okay, so those two aspects, people's past behaviour and being in relationship. And they're those the two parts I really want to explore this afternoon, because I think these are really important in our trust of God, is that we have both those aspects. And our past experiences are really important, because our past experiences can make us easily trust other people or instinctively distrust other people. And I think often as children we trust very easily. Have you ever had an experience when you pick up a child, like a toddler or like a one-year-old, and as you're holding them, they just sort of like throw themselves back in your arms and total trust that you're not going to drop them? And, you know, often when that happens, you're like, you know, you don't trust yourself that you're not going to drop them, but they trust that you're going to look after them. They have this just complete trust that this big person is going to look after them. And I think that sort of symbolises the trust that little children often have. But what often happens is as we grow older, we become less trusting. And sometimes that's because of experiences happen to us. You know, someone did drop us one day and we don't trust them anymore. Metaphorically, not necessarily in actual fact being dropped. But we start to trust other people less. And what happens is we start to really only trust ourselves. We only really rely on ourselves. The only one I can really depend on to do what needs to be done is me, okay? And we sort of fall into this pattern of, you know, we only really fully trust ourselves. And this, I think, then can impact our relationship with God. And I want to really explore an example from Scripture of someone who struggled to trust God. You may have heard of this character. His name is Jacob. He's the grandson of Abraham. Okay, so if you know Abraham, the great father of the Jewish nation, was asked to sacrifice his son Isaac and didn't, and then Isaac grew up and had twin boys, Jacob and Esau. And so Jacob grows up knowing of God. But I'm about to tell you an example from his story that demonstrates that he didn't trust God, even though he knew of God. He knew of God's past behavior. He didn't really trust him. And you can see it even in the way he speaks of God. He refers to God as his father's God. You know, he often says, "The Lord your God," to Isaac. So he knows of God, but he hasn't really claimed him for his own yet. While Jacob's mother is pregnant with twin boys, well, she obviously doesn't know it's twin boys, but she's pregnant, she's given a prophecy. The Lord says to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The elder shall serve the younger." And so this prophecy about these two people in her womb that will end up sort of leading great nations, but the older one will serve the younger one. And this was very radical for Jacob's time, where inheritance was very strong through the oldest son's line. So the older son should be the one in charge, the younger serving the elder. But Rebecca is given this prophecy that it's going to be the other way around for her boys. And so the boys are born. Jacob is the younger twin, but even right from the beginning, he's trying to take his brother's place. And the story goes, as he's born, he's come out holding onto his brother's foot. So the image is like he's trying to like pull him back in, like, "No, let me go first." So right from the beginning, he sort of tries to take matters into his own hands. They grow up. Jacob is very much mummy's boy, beloved by Rebecca. And Esau is his father's favorite. Esau is a very accomplished hunter. Jacob likes to hang around at home. And it eventually comes time for Isaac's quite elderly, and he's about to pass on the inheritance to who he thinks is Esau. Okay, so he wants to pass on the family blessing, pass on the inheritance to Esau. But Rebecca overhears this, and so Isaac says to Esau, "Go out and hunt me a goat, cook it up for me, and then we can enjoy a meal together and I'll give you my blessing." While Esau is out hunting, Rebecca, because she's overheard what's happening, she grabs Jacob, and together the two of them Rebecca cooks the meal for Jacob. Esau is a very hairy man, and Jacob's smooth-skinned, so he covers himself with goat skin to pretend that he is Esau, and goes in and deceives his elderly father, who's blind by this point, and he pretends to be Esau, and so he gets the blessing. And so you can see here, Jacob doesn't trust the prophecy. Jacob doesn't trust that this promise that God has given them is going to come true by God's doing. And he takes matters into his own hands. And I think that's such a good example of what I was saying, that as we grow older, we come to only really rely on ourselves. You know, I'm the only one who's going to get this job done. Okay? I'm meant to be the one in charge. Esau's meant to serve me. You know, Dad's about to give him the blessing. This can't happen. So I'm going to make sure it goes how it should. Okay, so clearly not trusting that God is able to bring this about. And I think the problem is Jacob doesn't know God personally. He knows about God, but he doesn't know God. God is his father's God. It's not his own. And so he gets this blessing from Isaac. As you can imagine, Esau's not very happy with his deception. And so Jacob actually has to run away because he's scared that Esau's going to kill him. And probably quite justified in being scared about that. So he has to go into exile. And as he flees, he says this to God: "If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God." And it's interesting in that I think if we just read this quickly, we can sort of see it, oh, you know, Jacob's trusting God, you know, God will be my God. But when you actually read it, it's like, no, Jacob's saying, if you look after me and protect me from Esau, if you give me material things, food and clothing, and make sure I come home again and get this inheritance that I've been promised, then I'll let you be my God. So it's totally conditional trust. I'm not sure you can even really call it trust at all. You need to make demands of God. So he's saying, you know, only if you prove yourself to me will I trust you. And I think in all of us, there's more of a Jacob than we like to admit. You know, we always want to say that we trust God no matter what. But I think that there's often a part of Jacob inside us. And I think partly why I think that is because when you look at the temptations that Jesus faced, it's really the same thing. I'm going to read to you now from Matthew. Jesus' temptation in the desert. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. This is Matthew chapter 4. And he fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterward he was hungry. I love that line. You know, doesn't eat for 40 days and he's hungry. Like, of course he's hungry. and the tempter came and said to him, if you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread. But he answered, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Then the devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will give you his angels charge of you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. Jesus said to him, again it is written, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. Again the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. And he said to him, all these I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. Then Jesus said to him, begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and ministered to him. So these three temptations that Jesus faces, I think, really mirror these demands that Jacob makes of God as well. The first demand, the order is a little bit different, but Jacob demands of God, if you give me bread to eat and clothing to wear. And this is really the first temptation when Satan tempts Jesus and says, you know, command these stones to become loaves of bread. It's a demand for God to meet our material needs. And this is a, you know, a great challenge for us because, you know, we have these needs and we're told to rely on God for our needs. But the difference is when we become demanding it of God rather than trusting he'll provide in the way that he sees fit. And God's response really to this temptation is an invitation for us to trust that he does care, but the need that he will meet is our real need, not the needs we think we have. You know, we might think we have a need for this bread. You know, Jesus was really hungry after 40 days. And I was reflecting on these temptations, actually. I'm going off script a bit here now. A few weeks ago, I went up to New Norcia for a silent retreat, and I was reflecting on the temptations. And I was listening to a series. I don't know if you've come across Father Dave Callahan's series on the novitiate, but it's excellent if you haven't, or even if you have, it's still excellent. Anyway, he was talking one of these things about Jesus entering into our humanity, and I think I really realised for the first time that every time I've read these temptations of Jesus, I felt like the temptation that Satan offers is more like on the level of an irritating fly. Like, you know, Jesus is there, Satan sort of buzzes around, and Jesus sort of like just flicks him away, go away, you know. It's not really bothering him very much. It's just annoying him. But in these, after listening to Father Dave Callahan and reflecting on this, you know, after 40 days, he's hungry. It actually finally struck me that Jesus was actually hungry. Like, the lines in the scripture, I laugh at every time I read it, but Jesus was actually hungry. It wasn't just an annoying little fly. You know, he hasn't eaten for 40 days and Satan's offering him bread. I don't know what, you know, you're like, but if I haven't eaten in 4 hours, I get really hungry and I'll just eat anything in sight. You know, this is, you know, real hunger. Like, Jesus is actually hungry and this is actually, you know, tempting his human flesh, his desire for food. And that's really the core of, you know, with Jacob as well, you know, God, you have to meet my material needs because these are real needs. You know, hunger makes us feel really needy. But really, if we're really trusting God, it's trusting that God will meet the need, our real needs, not just what we think we need. The second temptation, Jacob says to God, if you will be with me and keep me in the way that I will go, if you will protect me, I'm going to enter exile because Esau wants to kill me. Like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know where I'm going to end up. I don't know how I'm going to feed myself or look after myself or be protected. If you protect me, then we'll be good. And really, here is a demand of God proving himself to us. We're sort of making bargains with God. And so similar to the temptation that Satan offers, you know, go up to the top of the temple and throw yourself down and God will catch you. Part of, I think, the challenge here is God says that he will look after us, but he doesn't necessarily stop us doing stupid things, you know. Climbing up to the temple and just throwing yourself off, that's pretty dumb. Like, why would you do that, you know? But how many times do we end up in our own mess? We do stupid stuff and we expect God to just sort of fix it, you know, like, click your fingers, God, fix this mess I'm in. And it's really, well, you know, what's gotten you in that mess? You know, our own doing often. And often what happens is we demand God fixes it without really acknowledging our own failings in that. And for me, this was actually a big part of my conversion many years ago. There was a habitual sin I was really struggling with in my life, and I'd ask God for help a number of times and nothing changed. Until it finally struck me one day that I'd never actually told God I was sorry for this thing I was doing. I was just sort of demanding God fix it. And so one, I actually, and it's one of those moments that I always remember. Like, I remember where I was in my car. I was fortunate enough to be able to drive to school. I was at the end of my driveway and about to turn onto the road, and like, I can picture it like it was yesterday. This moment where I was just really struck by the fact I hadn't said sorry to God and said sorry, and this immense feeling of forgiveness and this breakage of this habit of sin in my life. But if we don't acknowledge our failures, our failings, and we just demand God fix stuff, it's like we're just climbing up to the temple and throwing ourselves off and going, catch me, God. And God's sort of standing there going, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? So we can trust that God will catch us when we fall. He will catch us when we fail. He will catch us when we don't live up to our own expectations. But we actually have to admit to God our own responsibility in those situations. And so Jacob, doesn't say to God, I stuffed up, I didn't rely on you in trusting this prophecy, and now Esau wants to kill me, I'm really sorry, please protect me. That's not where Jacob comes from. He's just like, well, now life sucks, you better look after me, you know. And that's where God sort of waits for us to come to really realize our own situation. The third temptation, Jacob says, if I'll come again to my father's house in peace, if I will receive my reward, receive my kingdom. This is the inheritance he's been promised that he's now running away from. And he's like, well, if you guarantee that I'll end up with this, then you will be my God. And this is the same temptation that Satan offers Jesus when he says, you can have all the kingdoms of the world if you first worship me. I love Pope Benedict XVI's commentary on this in his book, Jesus of Nazareth. And what he talks about in there is that this temptation is the promise of a reward without the cross. Jesus has the kingdom, but he receives the kingdom, the fullness of the kingdom, through the cross, through the suffering. And what Satan is offering Jesus here is to have the reward without the cross. And don't we all do that? Like, none of us really want the suffering, but we want the reward. But that's not, you know, God's path. Thomas Aquinas, I think it is. I always get Aquinas and Augustine mixed up. I really wish they didn't have A names, because then it would be easier in my brain. But I think it's Aquinas says that, you know, if Jesus, you know, received his reward through the suffering, we can't expect to receive it any other way. You know, we're to walk in the path that Jesus lays out for us. And so, you know, we can demand of God that he gives us reward without our suffering. And God's response is, no, I won't take away your suffering, but I will use it to transform you. I will use it to bring about something glorious in your life. I will use it to make you into something that beyond what you can even imagine. It's very similar to Helena's word today about, you know, the potter and the clay, that God has to break us down and mold us. And if we really think about that, you know, that experience for the clay is not fun. Like, being remolded is painful, it is difficult, but that's the process that God often takes us through. And we need to trust that God is bringing about that transformation in our life through that difficulty. And really, how do we come to that? We can also look at the example of Jacob. So Jacob starts off really quite in a bad place with God. He makes this very conditional promise to God, and then he goes off. He meets his lovely, beloved wife, Rachel, works for her for 7 years, and then on his wedding night, his father-in-law does a switcheroo and marries him off to Rachel's sister, so he has to marry the ugly sister. Poor Leah. I always feel sorry for Leah in this story. And then he wakes up in the morning. I sort of think, Jacob, did you not even talk to her? Like, you probably could have figured this out for yourself. But anyway, he wakes up in the morning married to Leah and then has to work for another 14, no, maybe it was 14 years and then seven. Anyway, many years all up to earn his beloved life, Rachel. And then eventually it comes time where he is heading home. And he has this very interesting encounter when he's heading home. And it's in this encounter that Jacob really learns what the heart of his struggle is. Because up to now, he sort of feels like his struggle is with Esau, his brother. But he's on his way home, and he sends his wife and children and belongings across the river. And he stays on the other side. And while he's on the other side alone, he has this encounter with this man, and he wrestles with him all night. I'll just read you the passage. So the same night he rose and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything that he had. And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and Jacob's thigh was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And then he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then he said, "Your name shall be no more be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Tell me, I pray, your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. Then so Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." So he has this encounter with God, where and he wrestles with God all night. And he wrestles with God and is asking God, God bless me. So it's the same old Jacob, you know. Bless me, God, you know, this is what I want from you. But God doesn't bless him until something happens. Until Jacob says to him, tell me, I pray, your name. And it's at that point that God then blesses him. And this is going to be quite significant. In the Israelite culture, your name actually signified your identity. It showed who you were. And so when Jacob says to him, what is your name? He's just not like, oh, you know, what's your name? Oh, that's a nice name. He's really saying to him, who are you? And for us, you know, who are also wrestling with God, it's an invitation for us to really truly seek God, to seek to know, who are you, God? What is your identity? I need to come to know you so that I can trust you. And then once we come into this place where we really know God, that's when the blessings come. A little bit of time, so I'm going to chuck in my own personal experience here. So I have in 2016, my dad passed away very suddenly. He was diagnosed with liver cancer. The doctor told us he had 6 months to live and he died 9 days later. So it was very sudden, very traumatic. My mum ended up with post-traumatic stress disorder. She developed a stutter. It was very traumatic for her. And so in some way, I sort of lost my mum and my dad. You know, my dad was actually dead and my mum was, you know, a broken shell, really. And so that, it was very difficult for me in my relationship with God. And I really felt, it took me a long time to actually realize that this had impacted my relationship with God. And for a long time, I remember really struggling, thinking, oh, you know, maybe it doesn't really matter if heaven's real. Like, maybe it just matters if we have a relationship with God here on earth. And part of this is because my dad wasn't a churchgoer. I couldn't sort of rely on, it's okay, he's in a better place, I'll meet him again in eternity, because I actually don't know where he is. And so I couldn't rely on that. And so what I really was trying to do was find a way to still have my faith, but not worry about the eternity part. But the problem is I've studied too much of Paul's writings, and Paul says, you know, if it's for this life only we have faith, then we're just fools and idiots and the whole thing is pointless. So I couldn't really cling to that. And it became this real struggle in me of this struggle with doubt, really doubting whether God was real. It was very difficult because my job is I teach at our Acts 2 Bible College. I teach scripture, so I'm paid to tell people, you know, all about God and the ways that God is working, and I'd be standing up there, you know, teaching and feeling like I'm just a total hypocrite because I don't even know if God's real, you know, but I'm teaching you that it is. And, you know, I'd go to retreats and part of community and all these things, and I felt like this total hypocrite. But what was really exhausting about it is it was like this mutual doubt and belief at the same time. I felt like I had, you know, the angels on your shoulders, like the devil and the angel, both at the same time. And that's a really exhausting place to live in of doubt and belief, because yeah, there's nothing peaceful about that. And it was very difficult. And it was only when I started relating, I now have a spiritual director that I meet with, and he really helped me work through this and to see that this doubt I had was actually a form of self-protection. Because if God wasn't real, God couldn't hurt me. If God wasn't real, he couldn't do to me again what he'd done in taking my dad away so suddenly. And what really sort of rubbed the wound in a bit more was just before my dad died, a couple of months before, I'd been on a retreat, and the whole theme of the retreat was about joy. I felt like God was saying, you know, this theme of joy is, you know, and I'm not really a joyful person, so I was like, oh, that's exciting, I'll be joyful. And then 2 months later, my dad suddenly died, and I'm like, yeah, good one, God, thanks for that. So I felt really ripped off by God in that. And so this doubt was really self-protection. It was really, you know, I didn't have to face God because God, if God wasn't real. But coming to realize that it was only in realizing that I could then work through that. And similar with this thing of Jacob, like I really had to wrestle with this aspect of my doubt, to really wrestle with what was going on deep down inside to be able to move past it. And I would say it was really 4 years between when my dad died and me coming to a point where I can say I've sort of moved out of that place now. And that was a very hard 4 years. But I think in all of that, God is so gracious with us. Like, God is so patient and just sort of will keep walking with us, and we'll keep putting people in our lives, like the spiritual director I ended up with, to sort of help me move through that. And he will just be patient with us. You know, Jacob, he's an old man by the time he wrestles with God and comes to this realization. You know, he must be 40, 50, probably older though. You know, it's a long time in his life before he is finally able to wrestle this out with God. And that's what really God invites us into, is into this place of being really real with him. Allow him to really deal with the stuff, the doubt, the lack of trust that we might have in our lives, the real questioning of, God, I really want you to prove yourself, even though I'm not meant to ask that. I really want you to prove yourself. And God will meet us in that. You know, he was so patient with Jacob. You know, I would have cut Jacob off. Like, Jacob's an idiot. Like, no hope. You know, he would have been out of my will a long time ago. But God keeps working with him and brings him to this place of encounter and really is able to walk with him. And so I just want to finish with one of my favorite psalms. I love the psalms because to me they really show us how to speak to God. And I love that the psalms are often really real and they just tell God how it is. Like, sometimes we feel like we have to be pious before God, but that's not what the psalms show us. So this is Psalm 44. And I think it really models what I've been talking about, that that trust begins by knowing about God, but we really need to meet God for the trust to become real. And so it starts by saying, "We have heard with our ears, O God. Our fathers have told us what deeds you performed in the days of old. You with your own hand drove out the nations, but you planted them. You afflicted the peoples, but you set them free. For not by their own sword did they win the land, nor did their own arm give them victory. But your right hand and your arm and the light of your countenance, for you delighted in them. You are my king and my God, who ordained victories for Jacob. Through you we push down our foes, through your name we tread down our assailants. For not in my bow do I trust, nor can my sword save me, but you have saved us from our foes and have put to confusion those who hate us. In God we have boasted continually and will give thanks to your name forever." And so, you know, this beginning part is really declaring the things that God has done in the past. God, you've done all these amazing things and you've fought our battles and you've gone out and brought us victory, and we didn't trust in ourselves, we trusted in you, and, you know, how wonderful are you? And then in the psalm, it says this phrase, Salah, which means pause. Okay, so we're going to pause with that. And then the mood changes. "Yet you have cast us off and abased us, and have not gone out with our armies. You have made us turn back from the foe, and our enemies have gotten spoil. You have made us like sheep for the slaughter, and have scattered us among the nations. You have sold your people for a trifle, demanding no high price for them. You have made us the taunt of our neighbors, the derision and scorn of those about us. You have made us a byword among the nations, a laughingstock among the peoples. All day long my disgrace is before me, and shame has covered my face, at the words of the taunters and revilers, at the sight of the enemy and the avenger. So it's really this accusation of God. Oh, you did all these great things in the past. Yay for you. But you're not doing it now. In fact, you've left us, abandoned us, made us be persecuted and a laughingstock before other people. Like, what is going on, God? And it goes on. All this has come upon us, though we have not forgotten you or been false to your covenant. Our heart has not turned back, nor have our steps departed from your way. That you should have broken us in the place of jackals and covered us with deep darkness. If we had forgotten the name of our God or spread forth our hands to a strange God, would not God discover this? For he knows the secrets of the heart. No, for your sake we are slain all the day long and are counted as sheep for the slaughter. So the psalmist is saying, all this has happened even though we haven't betrayed you, we haven't turned our back on you, we haven't forgotten you, we haven't, you know, fallen into idol worship or sinned. You know, we're innocent, and yet, God, what is going on? And then it finishes up with, rouse yourself. Why do you sleep, O Lord? Awake, do not cast us off forever. Why do you hide your face? Why do you forget our affliction and oppression? For our soul is bowed down to the dust. Our body clings to the ground. Rise up, come to our help. Deliver us for the sake of your merciful love. And I love that ending of, you know, wake up, God, and come and do something about this. You know, and I love how real the psalmist is. You know you've done great things in the past, and that was lovely. But right now, you're not doing what you're meant to do. And everything is terrible and everything's fallen apart. And it's not because I'm, you know, done terrible things. Wake up, God, and come here now. And I think it really, for me, I feel like, this is the heart of what Jacob wrestling with God is about, is that real wrestle and saying, this is really how I'm experiencing life right now. This is how I'm experiencing this. Where are you in this? You know, where are you, God? Why won't you wake up and do something here? And that's what I think God really wants us to enter into. And it's in that really deep wrestle, struggle, that real gut-wrenching truth that God reveals himself. And it's in those moments then we can say, you know what, I can trust you. I know you will come to my help. I know that you are with me and are loving me and will guide me through. And that was my experience with this situation with my dad, is I was able to really face my fear. I remember after one session, it might have even been in the middle of the session, I just had this image of myself crouched down, hiding, like there was a wall here, and I was like a little kid crouched on the floor, cowering. And I felt like God was on the other side of the wall, kicking the wall, like trying to, you know, knock the wall down. But every time he hit the wall, I like shuddered and screamed out in terror. Like I was terrified of this beating against the wall. And it really brought me to realize that I was scared of God. I was scared of that wall coming down because that wall was protecting me. And this wall was this doubt that I was hanging on to. Even though I felt like I wasn't, subconsciously I was, because it was my protection. And I had to be able to let that wall down and let God, you know, pass through the wall, to really realize that, you know, God wasn't who I needed to fear. And a long time after that, you know, long processes, I was reflecting back on this idea of joy that God had given me before my dad died. And it's like, haha, you're so funny, God. But what I really came to realize is that I actually had brought joy in my life. And this was really difficult for me because I remember in the midst of really struggling with my dad dying, you know, that idea that God brings all things to good. And it's like, I don't want any good to come of this. Like, this is just awful. That I don't want to say, you know, my dad's death is a good thing. You know, I don't want to ever be able to say that. And I wouldn't phrase it that way. But I was able to see how through that experience, God took that suffering I was talking about, you know, the suffering that he allows to happen and transformed it. And to really, for me to come to realize that joy isn't about being, you know, all bubbly and excited about life, because I'm never going to be, I'm a very melancholy personality, I'm never going to be like that. But for me, joy is a certainty that God is there. It's a certainty that no matter what, even in the horribleness of my dad dying and my struggles that my mum had, and in the midst of all that, my brother ran off to America and almost killed him, except he was too far away. in all of that, God was with me. And so I have this real certainty now that no matter what happens in the future, God will be there. And I don't need to fear because God is with me. And that's where the real trust is, you know. It doesn't matter what happens. It doesn't matter whether my needs are met. It doesn't matter whether I have, you know, reward. All that matters is God is there and he is with me. Thank you.
Brothers and sisters, we're so fortunate that someone as gifted as Laura has been able to bless us, and thank you for blessing us with the reminder that